Well, turn back, if you would, to Esther chapter 3, to that chapter we read just a few moments ago, as we're going to try and see if we can understand this strange little story there in the book of Esther that we began looking at back in the beginning of December, before Christmas. We looked at the first two chapters of Esther, and then hopefully over the next few weeks we'll get back into it again as we look through the next part of it. And we've been looking at this, we call it the drama of Esther, sort of the title for the whole series, because the book is very dramatic, full of stuff going on by these larger-than-life characters, by these extreme events often that are happening in it. And the book of Esther is trying to involve us emotionally. It's not a dull history book we're reading here. It's not just giving us a little sentence or two, a few little facts and bullet points. But the writer of Esther is trying to move us to really sort of feel what's going on in it. Not just to have our heads engaged, but our hearts too, and our emotions in it. And so just to summarise where we've got so far, in chapter 1 of the book of Esther, we were setting the scene, and the writer was. And we were introduced to an empire, and its emperor. And there in chapter 1, we were introduced, say, to this vast empire of the Medes and Persians, that ruled over most of the known world, 127 provinces, all the way from Ethiopia to India, we're told in the first chapter. This vast empire, huge numbers of people under its control and power. It was an empire that was so rich, an empire that was vast in its size and its extravagance, the sheer wealth of the banquets that's described there in that first chapter. All the decorations, all the things going on in the capital are meant to wow us, and at the same time rather disgust us at the sheer over-the-topness of it all, the greed of it, the immorality, the corruption of it all. And we met this emperor, King Ahasuerus, and he's the king who has it all. He is still probably in history the richest man who's ever lived, corresponding to his sort of time through history. Probably the richest man there's ever been. This was the richest empire of the ancient world, and he was the one who was in sole control of the lot. He was the one who could give orders and they were obeyed, all the way from Ethiopia to India. He has it all, except the respect of his own wife. And when at the end of a drunken banquet he makes some demands of her, she dares to say no. And it rocks the entire empire, as we saw in that chapter. Then in chapter 2, we were introduced to some of the characters and some of the more key ones there. So we've had the king already, King Ahasuerus. And then we're introduced to probably the next key actor who's going to appear on the stage for us, Mordecai, and his adopted daughter, Esther. And we said right through chapter 2, there's this ambiguity to it all. What are we to make of Mordecai and Esther? They make one compromise after another, one rather dubious decision after another. We said they live in a very similar society to Daniel. And Daniel's the one who's gone down in history, dare to be a Daniel. This man who made a stand about all sorts of things in obeying the Lord. But Mordecai and Esther, they don't make any stand in the entire chapter. Not one. It seems all the things that Daniel stood for, they fell for. And so in all their compromises, we're unsure really what to make of these two as they're introduced to us. They don't go back to Jerusalem when other people do. They're not back there while this is going on in chapter 3. There's people back in Jerusalem rebuilding the city, starting to rebuild the temple. And they're not. And then in chapter 2, there's this competition to find the new queen. We said it's a scandalous, sleazy thing that's going on. It is a sex competition. And yet, Mordecai and Esther go for it. And Esther enters into it to become the plaything of a king for one night. And then to be discarded into his harem in the hope that perhaps she'd be the one who was chosen to be queen. Well, she does win. She does win the competition. She is the one who becomes the next queen. But even then, as the chapter draws to a close, is it really what they were hoping for? Were they hoping for power and prestige and influence? Were they even perhaps, as God's people, but rather keeping that on the down low, hoping that perhaps they could get into some position of influence and then have real power for good and to serve God? But there's no hint of that either. Esther's power isn't much. She does become the favourite queen, but as it will transpire later on, the king hardly sees her at all. It seems he's probably got other women as well. Her influence is very little. Mordecai perhaps himself was hoping for some promotion, hoping to be exalted to some position of power. Even the end of chapter 2, which we looked at another time, Mordecai discovers a plot to assassinate the king. He passes the news to Esther. Esther passes the news to the king. The plan is thwarted. And Mordecai gets nothing. He gets nothing at all. Was he hoping that this would be his way up the greasy ladder to some position of power? But he doesn't get it. And so the chapter begins in just the same way, that Mordecai is still one of the servants who's by the king's gate. Did they hope for power and influence? They get precious little. And chapter 3, enter the villain. In the story so far, it's unpacked the setting, it's unpacked some of the key characters, and then chapter 3, we need the problem in the story, don't we? But there needs to be some purpose to this story. And here it is, the villain enters the stage. Chapter 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Some time has actually gone past. We're told in chapter 7, it's the 12th year now of King Ahasuerus. So some time has gone past since it, but it links it, in verse 1, to the things that has just happened, to Mordecai and this plot he discovered. You might think Mordecai would get the promotion. But no. Mordecai doesn't get anything. And instead, Haman's promoted. Who's Haman? We've no idea. Why does he deserve this? We've got no idea. But here he is, suddenly put up here on the stage. And not just on the bottom of the stage, but he's there, exalted in the middle, second in command to the king. Haman is the one who has it all. And Mordecai refuses to bow. End of verse 2. Well, let's read verse 2. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Wow. Well, wasn't all meant to appear at once, but never mind. There's the consequences of the compromise. As I said in the previous chapter, there's all these implications of these compromises of Mordecai. And here he is. He ends up in this position. An unenviable position, of course, as we'll see in this chapter, but rather one of his own making, as we'll see as well. And Mordecai refuses to bow. He's the one who doesn't get the promotion. And that's the way it is, isn't it, in the world? It is not to the one who deserves it. Mordecai is the one who saves the king's life, but people don't always get what they deserve, do they, in the world? The one who deserves the promotion might not get it. Somebody else is just put there in place, and we've no idea why. And we don't have the answers to those questions, do we? Why those things may or may not happen. But Mordecai refuses to bow. He refuses to pay homage to Haman. Why? Is his nose out of joint? Is he jealous of Haman? Thinking to himself, that's what I deserved. I'm the one who saved his life. Why has the king not honoured me? How come Haman's got this? Is he angry with the king? It's pointed out a couple of times. It's the king's command that everyone should be bowing down to Haman. But is Mordecai angry with the king? The king for forgetting him and neglecting to make sure there was some proper recompense for his actions? Well, he tells them it's because he's a Jew. At some point, which is weird, because in chapter 2 he was telling Esther all the time, don't tell anyone you're a Jew. So how he'd managed for no one to know Esther was a Jew, even though she was related to him, and somehow it turns out in chapter 3 people know he's a Jew. So who knows, maybe he'd kept it quiet all this time, and now he's refusing to bow down to Haman, and everyone keeps asking him, verse 3, the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, though they told it to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them he was a Jew. So when that comes out, we don't know. But at some point, Mordecai tells them he's a Jew, and that's why he's not doing it. Now, it's important to realise, this isn't sort of implied that he's worshipping Haman, or the command is. To bow down to a king isn't actually something that's forbidden in the scripture. To bow down to an idol, to worship an idol, or to worship somebody, yes, that's forbidden. But plenty of people bow down to kings, all the way through the Old Testament. And most of the kings, quite happily, even King David would quite happily accept people bowing down to him. So it's not a question of worship, or idolatry, or something like that. But it is something to do with his Jewishness, which we'll come to later. But somehow Mordecai finally make a stand? Of all these compromises in chapter 2, and all the fact that their Jewishness seems to be completely hidden, and then at some point, in this situation with Haman, he finally says, I'm a Jew, and I'm not doing that. I'm not bowing down to Haman. And it seems that his colleagues, the other servants at the king's gate, in verses 3 and 4, they sort of pester him about it. A little bit of a kind of thing that can sometimes happen to a Christian, isn't it, there in the workplace? When the Christian says, no, I'm a Christian, I'm not doing that. And then there's all this pestering going on, but he won't listen to them. And so then they're going to try and see if his word stands. So it seems that perhaps they then try and deliberately escalate the situation to see if Mordecai is really going to stand by his words, that he's a Jew and he's not going to do it. All this time he's been compromising. They've known him for so long, maybe. And now he says, no, I'm a Jew. I've got principles. And they think to themselves, no, you don't. We've never seen a principle so far. So maybe that's why they're trying to antagonise him a bit in it. Who knows exactly, but here he is. Haman is told this story in verse 2. It's told to Haman what's going on. They deliberately go and tell tales on him. Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not bow down to him or pay him homage, so Haman checks it's the truth. Maybe he deliberately walks past Mordecai to see if he's going to bow, and Mordecai doesn't. So Haman knows it, and he's filled with wrath. But in verse 6, the whole thing explodes, doesn't it? Out of all proportion. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. And the whole situation escalates. The whole thing explodes out of all proportion, doesn't it? Mordecai, who's finally made a stand, antagonizes Haman, the second in command to the king. Haman is filled with wrath, not just to do away with Mordecai, but to do away with his entire people throughout the entire kingdom of Ahasuerus. He vows to destroy all the Jews. And yet it's a funny story, isn't it? Because in some ways, this entire problem now, this disaster that's unfolding, the blame lies at Mordecai's door, doesn't it? At least partly. Mordecai, who could have gone back to Jerusalem, could be helping rebuild the temple back there. He isn't. He's here. He's been compromising all this time. Now he's made a stand, and he's made a stand on this one thing that we'll come to in a moment. Does it really matter? But anyway. And then there's this massive fallout for it. The consequences of compromise. And isn't it one of the sad things about sin? That sin has its consequences. And compromises we can make as Christians can be damaging for years and years, can't they? And so it is for Mordecai, this sort of problem that he ends up in. It's kind of a problem of his own making, at least in the first place. Yes, Haman has his big part to play in that, but it is partly Mordecai's fault, isn't it? all these things that happen, this messy situation that we have. And yet, sometimes that's the way, isn't it? The way of sin. That's why we're warned against it. Not just because of its consequences, but there is that. That is often outlined to us in the scriptures. Not just that our sin is something that offends God, which is true. Not just something that it grieves God or has eternal consequences. But sins have consequences right here and now as well. And those things are often portrayed for us in the Bible. So we wouldn't have a naivety to it. And yet, so often we do, don't we? We're the ones who are guilty of compromises, aren't we? In our workplaces, in our family, when we're faced with a bit of antagonism or a bit of pressure from a non-Christian or somebody else, we're the ones who roll over, aren't we? And yet, how damaging that ended up here. How much we need to be those who dare to be like Daniel, to make a stand, to be those who are firm in following the Lord through thick and thin. Well, the story carries on. And as we said, enters the villain, this man Haman. Haman, who's promoted to be the second most important man in the kingdom. And yet he's a narcissist. That's what we find here in this. He's the one who's appointed above everyone. That's played out for us in verse 1. Haman is advanced and has set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Whether he was a prince, whether he was related to the royal family, sounds unlikely because of the way he's introduced. But so it more sounds like he's a member of the civil service, a little bit like a sort of prime minister or something like that, that this king then promotes in his kingdom. But he's set above all the other princes, maybe even the sons of the king. They bow to him. They bow to Haman. The king gives an order, verse 2, that everyone should bow down and pay him homage, show him respect and how worthy he is. What more could he dream of? Isn't Haman the man who has it all? And yet we see the illusion, don't we, of all the world offers. Here's Haman, and he has it all. But he's not happy. He's not content. And when he finds out, through a little bit of hearsay and telltale along the grapevine, that there's one man in the kingdom who won't bow down to him, that's enough to throw Haman off the deep end, isn't it? Haman goes ballistic. That there's one man out of all the millions of people in the empire who won't bow. And he's told. He's told about it. And it just can't get out of his head. He can't sort of think to himself, it doesn't really matter. Who cares less about this one obscure little man who won't bow to me? But he can't. He's completely hung up on this. That there's one man, Mordecai, who won't bow down, and it spoils everything. He's the man who's got it all except for one man bowing to him, and he can't leave it at that. He's rich, he's powerful, he has influence, he has prestige, he has the honour being given to him by princes of the empire. The king is the one who bows to his every whim, which we'll see through the rest of the chapter. And yet he doesn't have enough. He has everything the world offers, and he's not happy. He's not content. He's completely hung up on this one man who can't bow down. He's very much like Ahasuerus. And that often goes the way, isn't it? Who's Ahasuerus going to promote? Somebody who's just like him. And Haman is just like him. Because in chapter 1 we notice the insecurity of a king. A king who doesn't know what to do because his wife says no. That she's not going to parade around naked in his banquet. And his wife says no, and the king goes ballistic. And here in chapter 3, Haman goes ballistic in exactly the same way because his insecurities are shown up by one man who won't bow down. And the entire empire, which in chapter 1 was rocked by a woman who says no, now in chapter 3 is rocked again by Mordecai who says no. There he is, the insecurity of this narcissist. And so he hatches his evil plan. We're told in verse 7 that there's this casting of lots to his pagan god, it would be, to work out the right date divined by the gods and fate and the like for this to take place. And so they set a date, it's about a year's time from where it was, to set the date for this massacre. There it is, the villain who takes the centre stage in all of this. What are we to be reminded of? Again, as we said in chapter 1, of those words of the Lord Jesus. What is it if the man who gains the whole world and yet loses his soul? That's Haman, isn't it? He's gained the whole world. The second in command in the biggest, richest empire there's ever been. And yet, he knows he's got nothing. He's watching it slip through his fingers. He's not happy or content with all the things the world offers. It's nothing. And he knows it. And yet, how often do we clamour after those same things that Haman got up to that position? So many of those competitions in our world, whether it's pop idol or whatever it is, it's to try and get up there, seeking to get the next promotion, wanting to be the one in power, the top dog, as it were. Everyone clamours after it. And yet it gives them nothing. It gives them nothing, as Haman shows us. And so the story carries on. And then we see the sheer evil of it all. Haman hoodwinks the gullible king to agree to the extermination of the Jews. Notice how the story carries on in verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among all the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other people's, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it's not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And so Haman comes out with his speech to the king to wipe out an entire group of people who's been assimilated into the Persian Empire. And Ahasuerus, again, we've noticed him before in chapters 1 and 2, he's a fool, isn't he? He's a blind fool. He's no idea what's going on. And this won't be the last time. The king usually has no idea what's happening. Later on, Esther's going to invite him to a couple of little banquets, and the king keeps saying to Esther, what do you want? What's going on? He's got no idea what's happening in his own empire. So it is here. Haman talks to him about this people group. Ahasuerus never once says, hang on a minute, who do you mean? I'm sure I would have noticed before if there was an entire people group who were disobeying me constantly in my empire. Emperors normally intercepted that pretty quick. But Ahasuerus is completely hoodwinked by the lot. He's gullible. He just believes everything that Haman says. He's Haman's puppet in this, isn't he? He has no idea of what's really going on. It seems everyone else knows that what's going on is there's a falling out between Mordecai and Haman. King Ahasuerus hasn't noticed a thing. He's got no idea the real thing that's going on. And so the king agrees. The king agrees to this plan to not let these people remain. In its rather casual wording, first of all. Verse 9 carries on, though. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they all be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. That's a ginormous amount of money. 10,000 talents of silver was approximately 2/3 of their national budget. Where Haman was getting this money from, we've no idea. It sounds like Haman is going to pay this money either to the king or to the people who do the work, that's the killing. It's a bit of a strange sort of phrasing of it, isn't it? It's a huge amount of money. Where on earth this could come from, we've got no idea. Of course, these things cost a lot. Exterminating people, that is. Disposing of them and the like would involve an awful lot of people. Would need to employ an awful lot of soldiers and executioners and the like. So this kind of project would cost an awful lot of money. Or maybe he's talking about the money he's hoping to seize and plunder from the dead Jews and then bring into the king's coffers. don't really know exactly where this money is coming from and where is it going to. The king seems to sort of say in verse 10, so the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you. Do with them as seems good to you. It's unlikely the king is saying, forget about the money. Just do what you like. And kings rarely said that sort of thing. But again, it's a little bit far from clear. Maybe it's a sort of a polite, well, we'll talk about the money later. You get on with the job for now. We'll sort out the bill later on and what's coming to me. I say, but there it is. There's this money. There's this delight, this desire for yet more of it, this vast sum of money, sort of largely unheard of in their sort of time. And there it is. This plan is hatched. And out come the civil service. Verse 12. The king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written to all the king's, all Haman's commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who are over each province, to the officials of all the people, to every province according to its script, and every people in their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces, and the like. It carries on in verse 14. A copy of the document was issued as law in every province, being publicized for all the people that they should be ready for the day. Verse 15. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. They love the pompous language. They love it. We've noticed that a couple of times in before. They love making their laws. And this sort of these wheels of the civil service as they send out their letters to and fro across this vast empire is one that's been talked about before. Chapter 1, they're even inventing laws about how much people should or should not be drinking. There's laws to prevent an ex-queen from seeing the king she didn't want to see anyway. Chapter 2, there were laws being sent out and an entire branch of the government who's going to advertise and organise the competition for the new queen. And then chapter 3, out come the law for the final solution. And that's what it is. We use that word to refer to Hitler's plans for the Holocaust. Or here's Haman's plans for the Holocaust. It is painted in a very similar way. That final solution that he has come up with to eradicate the Jews. And notice just in this law that's rather sort of pompously being dressed out in how it's going out to all these different people and all the different bits and bobs and people involved in it. And then it gets to the actual wording of it in verse 13, and letters are sent out to all the king's provinces. And notice then the overuse of words. To destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews. That's a bit unnecessary, isn't it? You don't need to say the same thing three times. To annihilate, to destroy, and to kill. That's the same thing. Why do you need to write it down in law? But that's showing what it is, isn't it? The evil of this scheme. To destroy and to kill and to annihilate. Piling words atop of another to show the sheer depravity. The reprehensible evil of what is going on here. And yet it keeps then stressing the next words, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. Notice the way, sort of the gravity of how this is described. This is meant to be something we shudder at. It is like watching a documentary on the History Channel or something like that, on Auschwitz, or seeing a documentary or reading a book about a genocide in Cambodia or in Rwanda or something like that. Reading of some historical account of bloodshed and you read it or you're watching a documentary on the television and you shudder. And that's what chapter 3 is meant to make us do. It's meant to involve us emotionally. Now, we don't just read these words, but we think, God, this is horrifying. How could one man, Haman, be so convinced about this, so seething with hatred for Mordecai and for the entire people group to whom he belongs? We're meant to shudder at how a king could be so stupid as to go along with it. We're meant to shudder at the efficiency of the civil service, the bureaucracy, in getting this hideous, heinous job done. We're meant to be shocked, horrified, shuddering at the despicable evil that we have described for us in these verses. And isn't that something that we get so used to? It's one of those things, isn't it, that people often remark, and not just Christians, but other people too, that we get so used to things on our televisions. We get so used to the news stories about a bomb going off, or ISIS capturing one town in Syria, or whatever. We're so used to it. We're so used to hearing of a gun attack in America, or some drug cartel in Mexico, or Nicaragua, or something like that. We're used to these stories. They're so predictable. We see them so many times that we fail to be shocked by them. We fail to be appalled. We fail to grieve. Think of how God reacted when it talks in Genesis that God was grieved that he'd made man. When he saw the depravity to which they had declined, their violence and their bloodshed. We're meant to be those who see that too, aren't we? And yet there's one more thing to it all. There's an echo in all of this of a cosmic conflict. Haman's introduced to us in verse 1. He's the Agagite. Funny word to be used, but he's using it intentionally. There's an Agagite in verse 1, and we're told Mordecai is a Jew, verse 4. And that's part of what's going on. The Agagites came from the tribe of the Amalekites. And so in the Old Testament, there's all those conflicts between the Amalekites and the Israelites. And the Amalekites came from Esau. And the Israelites, of course, descended from Jacob. It goes all the way back to Genesis, to that conflict between two men, two brothers, two twins, Jacob and Esau. In Genesis 25, there's two boys who are struggling within the womb of their mother. And there it was forevermore. As the Israelites leave Egypt, it's the Amalekites who try to wipe them out on the journey. There's a battle that takes place in the book of Exodus. It's talked about the Amalekites, the ones who come round the back of the Israelites, killing off the weak and the weedy ones who are straying behind the group. Later on, when Saul becomes the first king, God says, you've got to remember what the Amalekites did. You're the one who's meant to bring justice, but Saul doesn't. And Saul's the one who's killed by somebody who claims to be an Amalekite. David fights them, but they're still around. We looked recently in our Bible overview in the books of Amos and Obadiah and Lamentations, and all of them talk about the Amalekites or the people of Edom. When Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians, the Amalekites were the ones cheering. The Amalekites were the ones who swooped in afterwards to mop up the leftovers of plunder and to kill the people who were left. And Mordecai no doubt remembered that. So why does Mordecai refuse to bow? Because Haman's an Agagite, their sworn enemy. And why does Haman want to wipe out every one of the Jews? Because he knows his history too. And yet in all of those things, there's a cosmic conflict. Because God chose Jacob. We read in Romans that God said, I've loved Jacob, but not Esau. I've hated Esau. God appointed that the older would serve the younger. Esau, even though he was the firstborn, he would serve Jacob. Esau hated God, despised his birthright, and Jacob was the one who was given the blessing. And God decrees judgment on them. And so this conflict carries on. And in Numbers, God talks about the Messiah who's going to come from Jacob. A star will shine, where we get the Christmas prophecies from. And it will come through Jacob. But at the same time, Haman, the Agagites, the people of Esau want to oppose it. And it's just part of that conflict. Satan wants to stop the prophecies of the Messiah coming true. And Satan uses Haman to do it. And so that's what the point of Esther's all about. Why do we have this funny little book here tucked away in our Bibles? Because it's part of a cosmic conflict. because Satan here wants to destroy all the Jews, not just in living here in the capital, but all of those, even back in Jerusalem. Satan wants to wipe out the lot through Haman, who wants to do it. That's what's happening here. God's purposes for the Jewish people, God's purposes to send his Messiah, stand on the brink of a knife edge. That's the whole book of Esther. Blink now, and it could all go wrong. If God's not in control of this, it's disaster. The Jews will be wiped out. The Messiah will never come. There'll be no salvation. God's purposes are there on a knife edge. What's going to happen in the next couple of chapters? And that's what we see, isn't it? Satan wants to stop God's purposes. Look at Revelation. It sort of sees it in a typically revelatory sort of way, with these sort of visions of this woman and the dragon who's trying to destroy her, and a child who's born, and the dragon who wants to kill him. And we even see the same in the Christmas story. In the Christmas story, just after Jesus is born, there's Herod. And Herod's from Edom, or from Esau. And Herod wants to wipe out the Messiah. The same sort of thing. These are just hints of this cosmic conflict that is going on between the Messiah and Satan. Satan wants to destroy, and here's one of his willing tools, Haman, to involve it in it. And there it is. And yet, even though God's not mentioned in the entire book of Esther, we still know he's got things under control. We still know that God has his plan, and he's promised it, and his promises cannot fail. Even though there now stands this arch-villain in the way, what's going to happen next? We've got no idea. Well, unless you've read the book before. But at this point, we've got no idea what's going to happen. It just sounds like a complete disaster. It seems absolute destruction is staring the Jewish people, staring God's promises in the face. Notice just the way the chapter ends. So the couriers went out, hastened by the king's commands, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Shushan was perplexed. Understatement. There it is. This evil has been written out in history. It's all now proceeding like clockwork to the entire annihilation of the Jews. And Haman and the king sit down with a pint. They've got not a care in the world. And everyone else is perplexed. But what the book of Esther doesn't say is that God's still on his throne. And so it is in our experience of the world. We see those doing evil. And so often it seems that they can hatch their evil plans and then sit down and have a drink. They care nothing. They're not even sensitive to what's going on at all. We see great evil taking place. We see the city of Shushan. We see the world that's perplexed. We see people that are afraid. People that are hurting. And have no idea where to look for hope. But we know something that's behind the scenes in the whole book of Esther, and that's still behind the scenes in all the world. That God's on his throne. We know that he's the one who's in control. We know his purposes cannot fail. That this didn't go wrong then, because we know the rest of the story. We know that the Lord Jesus Christ had to be born to be the Saviour. And so even if there is this struggle going on, even in the heavenly realms, we can still be sure that God is the one who's in control of it all. Let's sing of that in our last hymn. It's number 763. If you want to follow it in the hymn books, a reminder of where our confidence comes in a world that is so evil and perplexing. Let's sing together. We rest on thee, our shield and our defender.